I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week are monuments. As many of you may know, I live in Ottawa, Canada's national capital, and as the national capital, it is a city full of monuments and memorials. From statues of prime ministers lining Parliament Hill to the famous Five statue currently sitting outside of the Senate to local memorials honoring victims of violence, the city has plenty of monuments and memorials for anybody who is interested. You could make not only a full day of looking at some of these monuments, but really a week or a whole trip to the city in visiting these sites. And they are the subject of a new book by Tanya Davidson entitled Tours Inside the Snow Globe, Ottawa Monuments and National Belongings. And in this book, Tanya organizes a series of walking tours through the city to show how monuments can capture the attention of their visitors, while also demonstrating how they have an ongoing relationship with the city. So as a monument is at a location, the way in which individuals use that space, the way they conceive of that space, can change over time. So Tanya very effectively shows how monuments like the National War Memorial, the Ottawa Women's Monument, the Human Rights Monument, just to name a few, have been used by individuals in the past as a site or as sites of collective remembering and honoring, but also as sites for both national and civic engagement. And it really is a wonderful book. Tanya is a sociologist by training, and she is a professor at Carleton University. For the interest of full disclosure, I've had Tanya speak to my classes when I have taught on some of these subjects, and she was a guest on the Old History Slam, and somebody who I not only respect a great deal for her work, but very much enjoy hearing her discuss these issues. So I was incredibly pleased that Tanya agreed to give me more of her time to talk about this book. A different conversation, obviously, than what we had the last time. I will link to our last discussion between myself and Tanya from the History Slam a few years ago. I'll link to that down in the show notes. This one is certainly focused on the book, but more generally, the idea of memorials and monuments, how they're used, the relationships that people forge with them, and really get into this question of Ottawa as a city, as a locality, but also these sites being ones that are supposed to evoke national sentiment and bring people into a sense of national identity, despite being very localized to the city. And in my mind, there's a bit of a discrepancy between those two ideas. So we get into that a little bit at the end. So as I say, always enjoy talking with Tanya. And this conversation was certainly no exception. Hope you will enjoy it as well. So let's get right into my chat with Tanya Davidson. All right. And Tanya Davidson joins me now. Tanya, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm happy to be here.
Really happy to have you here to talk about Tours Inside the Snow Globe, Ottawa Monuments and National Belonging. Tanya, we were just talking that this is a book that is a long time coming for you. You are an expert in monuments, decoding these things. How did you, and I should say, I will link to this in the show notes too. You were on the old show, The History Slam, one of our best episodes, most downloaded episodes, big feedback on that episode. So I'm really happy to have you back. But for anyone who hasn't listened to that one or maybe hasn't looked at the book yet, what is your interest in monuments? How did you get into this topic? And particularly as it relates to tours and showing people around to these places, what drew you to that originally?
Well, it is, I mean, this research is coming out of my dissertation research. So it is a long time coming. And so like the earliest sort of inklings of it, I was a fully different person, you know. There's a lot of different origin stories. I did my undergraduate degree in Ottawa, and I was a tour guide for a little bit. So I used to stop at monuments in that capacity. And then I traveled around the world. I lived in Poland for a year, not the world. I lived in Poland for a year, and there were a lot of communist monuments everywhere in every small town. And it struck me as really interesting that like the Polish people I knew were, you know, had not great things to say about Poland's time under communism, but these monuments were still there. They hadn't been torn down. Some of them had. And so one of my Polish friends, I asked, and she said, well, you know, it's basically, she said, it's complicated. That was a big period in our nation's history and also in our personal biographies. They need to be treated with some nuance, I guess. I mean, I don't really know anything about Polish history to give any more. The point is, I saw these monuments and that kind of inspired me to think more about how they are a part of our living cities. They're not just about the past, but they do things in the present. They provoke sort of questions in the present as well. So that was kind of the origin story. And then when you get into a dissertation project, it just kind of sticks to you and you become it. And now I'm on the other side of this book and I want to do other things. Now I'm a monument person.
Yeah, and a very successful monument person too, we should say. So as you mentioned, you do or have done tours, and I think still do tours on occasion here in the nation's capital. One of the things that I'm curious about is the experience of doing that for people from out of town, because I think when you live in a place, monuments, especially maybe in Ottawa, where there's a lot of these things in the downtown, they can feel like they just recede into the background, that they, as you say, are just part of your daily life. You don't always take note of them. Whereas if you're a tourist coming in, you almost want to go and make a point of going to the National War Memorial, the Human Rights Memorial. So what do visitors to a place, in your experience having done these tours, want from memorials, and what do they expect on these tours to see and to learn?
I mostly give, there's two, the tours thing, like I give tours to like my friends' classes mostly now, or like on request things, that it's a fun sort of way to talk about monuments and a lot of different topics in Ottawa. But the book is called Tours Inside the Snow Globe because I really framed each chapter around a tour. So the tours are really good device to go both across space and through time, and across space and through time at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that was like the idea. So I talk about these monuments as these sort of actors in the city that aren't just existing in a vacuum. They have relationships to the place that they're in. They have relationships also, they have relationships to the past, obviously. They have a sort of hold on to a promise for the future, that people in the future will remember the thing they're standing for. And also they have a lot of, in the city, that Ottawa, that's a national capital, the monuments have relationships with each other and with the rest of the sort of architecture of the city to produce larger narratives about the nation. So that brings me to the next part of the title. It's Tours Inside the Snow Globe. And the snow globe is my metaphor for Ottawa itself. Hmm. That Ottawa is like imagined from the outside, as you're asking. It's imagined as this sort of playground of nationalism that you can just come and trot around and go to the different museums and see the very fancy neo-Gothic buildings on the hill that have all the interesting beaver carvings, et cetera, et cetera. But what I want the book to do, and what I hope to do as a sociologist, is shake up this snow globe, to continue the metaphor, right? To disrupt it and to show how actually there is something very deliberate being produced here. But what's being produced is also challenged all the time through activism, through also just changing understandings of history. And there are also within the built environment itself, monuments that are rupturing these national narratives just by their own existence.
And how much does the use of a monument impact that? So the way in which the public associates with it, you know, one of the things I deal with all the time when we're talking about pop culture and radio is you can create something all you want. You can write a script and have it in your head. It means this, and then the audience gets it and they do something completely different with it. Is that the same for monuments? particularly when it's going to be part of people's daily lives.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I'm kind of always in tension with people with conversations about design, because it is really outside of my wheelhouse, and also as a sociologist and also just as a person, I'm just like not that not interested. I have no eye. I don't have much of opinion. But what I found with the monuments that I studied is that some monuments have huge budgets, have fancy, higher, you know, have international design competitions, and they're little visited. They're rarely visited. And then other monuments are very grassroots, are very modest in both the resources that went into building them and also the space they take up, and can have a huge impact on the community. So it is absolutely, monuments get their potency through their everyday life, through how people engage with them. And this can be very sort of, this is not to say that the monuments that you think people are ignoring are not significant. Because a lot of the times monuments, you don't know they're significant until they're being threatened to be removed. And then suddenly people are like, no, 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 I love it. Yeah. That's my favorite one. But that I would say the best example I have of that is a monument that I really feature in the book, called Enclave, the Women's Monument. And you must be familiar. Yes, I must have taken
it. Yes, yes. We've been to it together. Yes.
Yes. So this is for your listeners. This is a monument in quite a small park in downtown Ottawa. It's very close to other bigger monuments on Elgin Street, which is where the War Memorial is. And Enclave, the Women's Monument, was built in 1992. The work of feminist organizing and activism around responding to violence against women. The monument, the whole monument project had a budget of about $10,000. Each artist was paid $750. It's very small. Even for 1992, 1990, a monument to human rights was built that had a much larger budget and it has a much more prominent spot. Yet this small, rather modest monument is like the beginning spot or the end spot of rallies and vigils and protests multiple times a year. It's one of the most frequented monuments.
So the thing about Enclave that I think is really interesting in this context too, is that, so I had a group here in 2021. So I do overseas battlefield tours a few times a year with the Vimy Foundation. And in 2021, we couldn't go overseas. So we decided, all right, we're bringing all the students to Ottawa for Remembrance Day. So kids came in on Monday. We had Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday was the Remembrance Day, and they all went home on Friday. So Thursday for Remembrance Day, we went to the National War Memorial. You know, it was November the 11th, so a little chilly, and we were there for a couple hours. And then we had planned to go to the National Arts Center just to be inside to eat lunch there. But before we did that, I took everybody down Elgin Street to the park, and we went to Enclave, and we did it. And then we walked back up the canal to the National Arts Center. So rather than literally a 2-minute walk from where we were standing to get inside, I took everybody on what ended up being about a 45 minute to an hour additional outside time.
Yeah.
And even though we had been to this national event at the National War Memorial and ostensibly were there to understand the memory of war, afterwards, in the comments that they send in, and even a couple of kids came up to me that day and said that that site was the most important one for them. That's the one that they were going to remember. And again, we had been to all these major national sites, national memorials, and this in this little park, this it's not physically a very imposing memorial, and yet it has this very significant impact. And for you as a sociologist, how much does that inform your work in terms of understanding how people are interacting and responding to monuments versus the intended purpose of why they're there?
Well, that was my entire interest. So I like my research was based on some archival research on the life of monuments since they were born, but also some participant observation. So I wasn't actually that interested in, I did talk to some designers, but my focus was more on the monuments after they had been unveiled. So that is like, as a sociologist, that is what I was entirely interested in, this relationship between monuments, people, their environments.
And so when you were putting this book together, as you said, the book is separated by tours, essentially. Each chapter is its own tour. How did you develop those? Are those actual tours that you have given, or did you group those based on the memorials and the themes that emerged?
The second one.
Okay. Yes.
There are, I mean, it's a narrative device. It was an organizing device. Some of the, there are maps. I hired a cartographer. There are maps. Some of the tours would be very easy. For example, I give three of the chapters are different sort of time traveling tours of the site of the war memorial. So you can easily do that. Those tours, you could be sitting there at Confederation Square in maybe the cold, reading for a long time, because it's three chapters in my book. But that's what, so those tours, one thing I forgot to mention is that each of the tours has a tour guide. And the tour guide is a sort of inspired by these children's books I had when I was a kid that were, maybe you're familiar, they're the white hardcover, and it was the Value Of series. Did you get this?
No, I'm not familiar with those.
They were all sort of biographies of historic figures like Thomas Jefferson or Terry Fox, and they all had like a magical sidekick. So like Terry Fox had like a magical shoe, and that was like the narrative. Anyway, so that was kind of my inspiration for the narrators. So in each chapter, something sort of magical guides us through the tour, for the most part. So in one chapter called the Astrolabe Tour, it's the upside down astrolabe that Champlain is holding, this monument Champlain's holding. And it is a great sort of metaphorical tour guide, because it is both a sort of navigational device, but also it's upside down.
Right.
So it offers a sort of upside down, or i.e. critical reading of representations of colonial violence and indigeneity in Ottawa. So that was the tour guide. But at the war memorial tours that you could do, as I said, if you're prepared to sit on that bench for a while, I have a poppy is a tour guide at one point, for one chapter, and a fleck of mica in the granite offers this sort of flickering tour guide of the monument through time. Those are most time traveling. But the other tours, the other one that would be really fun tour to, that you could easily do depending on the state of the renovations, is the Laura Secord. She wiggles her toes and finds herself able to move. And she does a tour of the monuments on Parliament Hill and a little bit around that area, focusing mostly on, well, exclusively on the female figures, of which there are many more than people think of, because people usually ignore the nameless allegorical women in the like togas sitting at the base. So that is what her tour takes us to in that chapter. So you could absolutely do, you could do the tours. There are maps for each chapter.
And how did you come up with the themes and the narrators? Like what draws the monuments together, especially where there is some overlap, as you say, with the war memorial, that you could spend a lot of time there? It is a pretty central place. So how did you come up with the various themes, and how did you decide what to include? Because this is not a full inventory of every memorial in this city. That's another project that you have. So, you know, there's obviously going to be some, by nature and by necessity, a decision made not to include certain memorials. So I'm curious about just the decision-making process.
Well, this goes back to too many years ago, because it's a question of like my dissertation research. I focused on four monuments in the city: the monument to Champlain and the what was then the unnamed scout. And this was like, it's very central. There was a very interesting sociological story of the protest around this racist depiction of an Indigenous man and how this scout was moved. So all of that was part of I think that was the first monument that I became interested in because of that story. So there was a big moment of protest in 1996. So that was an obvious one. The War Memorial was another obvious one because it is very central to Ottawa. And so asking questions about the role of monuments in the broader sort of fabric of the city in which they are, and specifically in the capital city, the National War Memorial is doing a lot of heavy lifting of producing very clear and nationalist ideologies in this capital city space. So I had to include that. And then the Human Rights Monument and the Violence Against Women monuments were both just so heavily frequented monuments that they were very compelling to me as well to think about monuments and the role of the sort of unfolding everyday life. So I guess the ones that would be more surprising to people maybe picking up the book is my treatment of the monuments on Parliament Hill, mm-hmm. of which there are many. Yeah. And I only talk about them in this sort of gendered tour of done by Laura Secord, which is probably my least sociological tour. It's the most sort of straightforward semiotic analysis of what's going on there. But the things about the on Parliament Hill monuments are, they are engaged with, but in a much more with a tourist gaze, and it's less, they're less in the fabric of the everyday life of Ottawa. So they were kind of less compelling to me.
And how do you balance that in the book of understanding from a sociological perspective, monuments as local and part of everyday life and the War Memorial, as you say, there's a lot of heavy lifting with the memorial because if you live here and you drive up and down Elgin Street, like if you live in the market and you work down in the Glebe, say, and you drive that, you shouldn't drive that, but other ways to get around. But if you do choose to drive that, you're going past that War Memorial every day. I walk past it every day when I worked at Parks Canada, and it just kind of blends into the background, whereas a tourist view of it is going to be very different. Same thing with Parliament Hill. Like Parliament Hill, to a certain extent, can bleed into the background here. So as a sociologist, when you're trying to assess these memorials, their place in the city, in a location that is very tourist heavy, how do you understand those or situate these monuments between the tourist gaze and the local gaze?
That wasn't really something I would, I did just mention that in terms of my less interest in Parliament Hill, but I didn't really approach the monuments with that distinction in mind. It just like I studied the monuments and looked at what sort of narratives were being produced. So the monuments of the four I focused on, three of them are explicitly sort of oriented towards a national narrative. And Enclave is a part of national commemorations of violence against women because it was unveiled on December 6th, 1992, which is the anniversary of the what is called the Montreal Massacre. But that is it. Otherwise, it is absolutely a very local monument. But it is also, like the Human Rights Monument, they're both used to attend to global issues as well. So when there was like violence against Asian women in the United States during the pandemic, the vigil was at Enclave. So it came out in my analysis, but not in my choice of monuments. And in all of my studies, I also pay close attention to these locations the monuments are in. So chapter, for example, I have a whole chapter that details the history of what is now Confederation Square, where the National War Memorial is, to look at and I make an argument about how placing the War Memorial there actually killed Ottawa's one public square space. That it was a dynamic space of like a hotel and a theater and a post office and parades and labor strikes and a lot of things going on, and picketing And now downtown Ottawa doesn't really have such a gathering space. We have highly securitized national spaces like Parliament Hill, and that, and the national, and now Confederation Square. It's very limited what you can do there.
Yeah, and I'm curious then how the changes to the city then change monuments. You mentioned the change with putting the War Memorial at what is now Confederation Square. Mm-hmm. You also have changing environments in the time where this book was being written and published. Certainly a few years ago, the convoy protest, that changed a lot of people's perception, I think, locally towards some of these sites. The War Memorial was very much a flashpoint during the convoy protests. So how does the growing, and we don't have to talk about the convoy in particular, but how does the city and the development of the city and the way these sites are being used and conceived both locally and across the country, how does that change the perception of them? Because I would imagine as a sociologist, using monuments as a site of protest, which is certainly the case, not only the War Memorial, but I think the Famous Five is another one that has protest associated with. People use it to advance causes. And I think the Human Rights Memorial certainly is another one that has a lot of protest locally to it for a variety of causes. But how does that changing, the ever-changing face of the city, the ever-changing face of use of monuments, how does that get incorporated into an analysis that to a certain extent has to be static because a book gets published at a given moment in time?
Yeah, that's a great question. Very frustrating. People think studying monuments is easy. They don't go anywhere, right? They're stone and bronze. But I do talk about this a little bit in one of my chapter because there are a couple of monuments that are very old in Ottawa that have moved a lot. And you can see, you can track their like trail. They just keep getting shuffled because buildings are produced. So, for example, the Boer War Monument and the Sharpshooters Monument, or the Northwest Resistant Monument, those were both in Major Hills Park. They were moved when the Chateau Laurier was built in 1912. They moved to where what became the NAC is now, the National Arts Center. Yeah. And they moved again. And the, I don't know, I'm missing maybe one point, but the Boer War Monument ended up in Major Hills Park. And the Sharpshooters Monument moved and is now by the Cartier Drill Hall. And this is always interesting story to me because yes, cities change, but also our understanding of the value of what's being commemorated changes because that Sharpshooters Monument commemorates two white settler men from Ottawa who were part of a group of men who during the 1888 Second Riel Resistance gathered in Cartier Hall and trained for about a week before marching to the train station and going out to Saskatchewan to fight against Pound Maker. And these two men died. And this monument is commemorating them. So when I go on my tour, sometimes I ask students or people, I'm like, so in 2024, when we understand the Riel Resistance as not this celebratory nation building moment, but as actually a moment in which members of settler society were being persuaded to fight on the side of a state that was launching a starvation campaign against Indigenous and Métis people in Western Canada, then that monument to these two sharpshooters that's now in front of the drill hall might find itself on the move again.
Right.
So that is, I don't know if that's answering your question, but I want to tell the story about those monuments moving. But I will, the second part about the convoy, I will just say I was so close to being done this book. It was like peer review. It was like copy edited. And then I got an email from my editor saying the board is insisting you must engage with the convoy. I just read that section before this podcast and I do, but it to be honest, which is, I mean, things change and you can't just throw something out because it doesn't go with your analysis, right?
Yeah.
But it was challenging a little bit because I spend this whole chapter making an argument about this expanding aura at the National War Memorial and how securitization has expanded and how this like reverence. And then in 2022, well, actually, less known, in 2020, there was a whole encampment from the Canadian Revolution.
Oh.
On like from July till October, there were people camped out with all these anti-Trudeau. Like the first time I saw a fuck Trudeau sign, it was then.
Okay.
And they were not moved out. They were not forced to leave until October, when it was decided it was undignified for them to be there during a ceremony to commemorate the murder of Nathan Cirilla.
Right.
But they were there for 6 months. They were there for a really long time. And also that was in 2020, but also in 2020, underreported, somebody etched a swastika on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, on the bronze part. And so this, like, my, what was really, really vexing for me was that earlier in my chapter, I talk about this moment in 2006 when a couple of men urinated on the monument, and it caused such a large response, and it led to the stab, putting the sentry there and all stuff. And then, so 2006, 14 years later, there's the most vile and not accidental, not a drunk person, but explicit and vile act of defacement. And there's barely a peep. So, and then there's during the convoy, the people dancing on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And it just kind of gets wrapped into everything else that's going in that moment. So I talk about it as just with the suggestion that we need to keep track of the sort of threads of affect that are being compelled and generated as these sites, as something that's meaningful to pay attention to.
And how does the book, or maybe not even just the book, but you as a sociologist too, and someone who writes about this and understands this, make space for competing understandings and interactions with these monuments and with these spaces? Because for some, the War Memorial is a place of nation building, right? Like, I deal with it in my job, the idea, you know, Vimy, Birth of a Nation. You can buy that hat online if you want, right? And there are people who very much adhere to Vimy as being this foundational moment in Canada. So they will look at that monument through that lens, whereas, say, a Silver Cross mother might look at that monument with a very different perspective and through the lens of somebody who has lost a child in combat. So you have those two individuals who can come to the same space, the same physical monument, and have two very different perspectives, two very different reactions and associations with that space. So how does the book acknowledge that while also trying to get through your analysis of how these spaces operate and function within the city?
Well, the crux of my analysis is that most monuments are these like deeply ambivalent sites, right? And that means that they can pull you very powerfully in many directions at the same time. So the War Memorial, for example, I have a lot to say about the Vimyism that, you know, historians have identified that is produced there, like the very like over the very explicit narratives of Canada being born, and how that is really problematic and narrow. But at the same time, the monument is also, I think, quite effective. I'm very moved by it, especially at night when it's like lit and there's the long shadow. I'm moved by how the designer, the Vernon March, like had the facial expressions, how they are sort of very earnest and but not triumphant, and how so many people can see themselves in this monument because of the 22 figures representing all of the types of the response. I think that the monument, like Mackenzie King's vision as the prime minister in his call for designs, was that it should be a monument to express Canada's response to this global crisis, but not to glorify war. And so I see that as well. I think that's quite effective. And you can see all these things that these global wars happened. It destroyed a lot of families, right? It was horribly tragic. And this is something worthy of noting and commemorating, mm-hmm. that you can do this at the monument, and you can do this while not holding on to a lot of sort of nationalist ideologies that are narrow and fraught, or you can do this and hold on to those. you can have a lot of different feelings at that monument. And that is actually one of my big arguments in the book. So my book is not really a for or against monuments.
Sure.
It's just trying to make sense of how they operate in cities.
And what about moments of tension where, like, again, we don't have to spend the whole time talking about the war memorial. It's just a one where there so much is put onto that memorial, where the First World War, you can say, yes, moment of triumph to a certain extent. A lot of people did die. It's a point, a place of mourning for a lot of folks. But you also have the reality that there are a lot of people who didn't support the war. There were issues associated with conscription, linguistically, geographically. Like, there's age-wise, there's so many things that, while there were some people who came together during the war, there was a sense of nationalism that did exist and was put forth by the federal government, and people, you know, people enthusiastically by the thousands went and signed up for the war. Thousands enthusiastically protested against it as well. So how do these monuments allow for the space for those competing narratives to emerge? Because that's one of the things that I've always struggled with monuments, is that when you go to them, the interpretive panels, or even just the way that they are formed, is trying to give you a message. And oftentimes that message inherently misses something, so or omits something on purpose. So how do you kind of drag that out when you're writing about these and putting together these tours?
Yeah, well, I think that the monument, especially what people have done around the war memorial since it was created in 1939, has in a few ways expanded how we can understand war, but it's mostly narrowed it. So in the 1980s, they added different dates, for example. They added World War II in Korea. We saw again more recently, they added the dates of the Boer War and the war in Afghanistan. Two different, I mean, people would have different opinions of that. But mostly what has happened at the war memorial is this really narrow fixation on Vimy. So the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, the remains are a Vimy casualty. Yep. We have, since the early 2000s, commemorated Vimy Ridge Memorial Day in April. So now we have Remembrance Day in November, Vimy Ridge Memorial Day in April. So when I give my tour, I stop at the Valiance Memorial by Joseph Kiabla. And he is a Quebecois Victoria Cross winner from, or recipient, sorry, from World War I. And I stop there to say, oh, and look at here, this Valiance Memorial is doing this work of trying to be this nod towards inclusivity, right? Like, English and French Canada came. But that is where I tell the story of the Easter Monday riots of 1918. Mm. And how, just like what you're saying, that actually the huge casualties at Vimy were part of the push towards conscription, which led to great domestic strife in Canada. And so does the war memorial allow us, and the Valiance Memorial allow us, to engage in this nuance? No, it doesn't. And it's not, and I would say it's not the monument's fault. It is the ritual and protocol that we've developed around the monument more.
Right.
Especially the triple layers of security, which now make it even more difficult to walk up the steps and get close to the monument.
So at the war memorial, there is, as you say, layers of protection. There's a ritual to it. There's no ritual, as or not as much of an established, well-known ritual at smaller local monuments. So without those established rituals, does that alter the relationship between the public and the monument? And does it matter if it does?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to, this is a methodological question, which I think I mentioned in my last podcast with you, so I don't want to be repetitive, but it's like, it is really hard to know how these things are, how people feel about things that you don't necessarily have modes of expression for, right? So a lot of people might have great feelings towards monuments and do nothing, leave no traces. Right. But another thing that's interesting is that the traces left at the War Memorial are very clear. It's so central. And after the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was interred there, that first Remembrance Day, it was like kind of a spontaneous thing and people were putting their poppies on the tomb, right? Yep. Which is very, very moving. But versions of that happen at other monuments across the city that you probably just aren't familiar with, right? The people leave rocks, stones at certain monuments. People also leave poppies at other war memorials. People leave flowers and candles at monuments all the time. So it's just something we don't quite have access to because there are a lot of monuments and there are services. There's a small monument to a South American general in Minto Park, and I have been there just like have my little iced latte, and cars have emerged and it's come out. There have been full ceremonies there, right? So these things are more attended to than probably meets the eye.
So the book is obviously about Ottawa and the monuments here in Ottawa, but having spoken to you over the years about these topics and having engaged with the book, I would argue that there are things in here that anybody who lives anywhere across the country could take and get into. Because there, as you say, there's a question about nationalism, but really there are things that are, while specific to Ottawa, apply in other cities across the country. Really, everyone has monuments, like every city puts stuff up. So what would your pitch be to folks from coast to coast to coast to engage with the book? Because I think I don't want anyone to get the false impression that if you've never been to Ottawa or don't want to be in Ottawa, this doesn't necessarily apply to you and you shouldn't be interested in it. Because I do think it's a broader base of a story and there are lessons in here and things that can be taken beyond the borders of this city.
Thank you for that. That's a really generous question, Sean, because it is nice to think that people outside of Ottawa would be interested in the book. I think that there is a lot, especially the stories about the War Memorial, would have great resonance for people in small towns and cities across the country, because there are memorials to World War One everywhere across the country. And you can think about sort of what ideas about the war being produced there through rituals. I talk also about Remembrance Day sort of broadly and the potency of the poppy and women's involvement in creating the poppy as a memorial symbol. And what is the Silver Cross Mother and why are mothers so central? So that kind of stuff is very relevant for people who ever have attended anything on Remembrance Day. I also, like, my first two chapters are about this, are about indigeneity and colonialism in Ottawa, which also would find a lot of parallels across the country. So I make reference in my conclusion to different monuments toppling around the country as I'm writing the conclusion. A lot of John A. Macdonald statues. Ryerson, of course, in Toronto, and make sense of that in light of my analysis of the Champlain and the Indigenous Scout Monument in Ottawa. So I think that especially in the Canadian context, but also more broadly, I've been on panels talking with monument scholars in the United States, and there are definitely parallels with what's going on with Confederate statues and the States as well.
Yeah, monuments just make up such a big part of city landscapes, even if not always consciously, that we might not always be aware of them and stop and look at them, but they're there. And especially when you go to a new place, they are a lot more noticeable because you just see them everywhere. Whereas, you know, in your city, they can kind of fade into the background. But the fact that they do fade in the background or can fade in the background for locals also speaks to their ubiquity and their power.
Well, this is the thing. Sociologists, we always, one of the sort of key sort of catchphrase, the beginning premises of sociology is to challenge the things that are taken for granted, right? Mm-hmm. Like taken for granted ideas about how the world works, but also statues are also very taken for granted. Oh, yeah, that's always just been there. But we can ask questions about why and should we care more? Or is it okay if it's melted down for new uses, et cetera?
Yeah. And as you say, they're always changing, and it's important to understand why they were put up and how they change over the years and what purpose they serve contemporarily. And that is one of the reasons why the book is so good and such an important resource. And I'm so glad that it is out in print. So again, it is Tours Inside the Snow Globe, Ottawa Monuments and National Belonging. Tanya, if people want to get a copy of the book or keep up with all the other stuff you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Blue Sky. I'm just on Blue Sky. That's where it's at. I don't know. I do. Yeah.
Okay. And we're always big fans of local independent bookstores. They'll always order it for you if you want the book, and you do that from our friends at Wilfrid Laurier. They're good at setting up with that.
Local Ottawa bookstores are the best. You just go talk to them and say, show them a picture of your book on your phone and they'll order it immediately. They're just the sweetest. Black Squirrel, Singing Pebble, all the local independent bookstores in Ottawa have my book right now. So thank you so much for letting me talk about it.
Yes. And Tanya, thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay. You're welcome.
So there you have it, my discussion with Tanya Davidson. Again, I thank her for her time. The book is Tours Inside the Snow Globe, Ottawa Monuments and National Belonging. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the Toronto Star on November the 9th, 2024. It is a special opinion piece by Tim Cook entitled, "Sacrifices Are Easy to Forget in Times of Peace. Here's how the National War Memorial has changed with the times." And Tim Cook is the chief historian at the Canadian War Museum here in Ottawa, a very well-known figure in military history. And in this article, he goes through and discusses the creation of the National War Memorial, which was unveiled in 1939, just a few months before the outbreak of the Second World War, after nearly two decades of debate and discussion of what it should look like, where it should go. As Tanya mentioned, this was a public square in Ottawa. If you look at images, and even you can find some videos of the city in the early 1930s, parking, there's a lot of parking spaces here, a place for people to gather. And this is where they decided to put the National War Memorial. It is close to Parliament Hill, between Parliament and the Chateau Laurier. So a very prominent place, especially at the time, where a lot of politicians would stay and live at the Chateau Laurier when they were in town. So certainly a very prominent location here in the city. And it was selected, the design of Canadian service members from the First World War pushing through an arch is very evocative. And in this article, Tim goes through to show how that meaning that was placed into the monument, or the intended meaning in its design, really changes almost as early as its unveiling, with war clouds gathering in Europe, and then certainly following the Second World War, how the relationship with the monument changes. Debates over whether or not there should be a Second World War specific monument, that of course never happened, and the Second World War and Korea are subsequently added to the National War Memorial in 1982. Another rededication in 2012 put the War of 1812 and Afghanistan, in 2014, a subsequent rededication puts Afghanistan and the War of 1812 on the War Memorial. So the meaning of the memorial has changed. The monuments, the conflicts that it is honoring have certainly changed in the 85 years since its unveiling. The events with Nathan Cirillo, he was killed in 2014 while he was on ceremonial sentry duty, which is another event certainly worth memorializing and commemorating. And given that it happened at the War Memorial, that has become connected to that site. The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier added in the year 2000. That, again, changes the site, the way people conceive of the site, use the site, certainly on Remembrance Day. And as Tanya and I talked about, that was a major discussion point during the protest here in the city back in 2022. So a really wonderful article here by Tim Cook, going through the history of the memorial and how it has changed over the years, and how the perception of Canadians and the way in which people gather and use and conceive of that memorial has changed. Just a really wonderful piece from November 9th, 2024. Sacrifices are easy to forget in times of peace. Here's how the National War Memorial has changed with the times. Today's historical headline of the week. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe. Whatever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of the past episodes are there under the podcast tab, all the great written material. If you missed it, the year in review, 100 years later, with myself and Aaron Boyce, we went back to 1924 to look at all of the biggest events of the year. Always a lot of fun to write that with Aaron, and you can go and see if you agree with our selection of the most important event of 1924, now that we have 100 years of historical context to put on to those events, and see if you agree with our selection there. And of course, all the other great written material, wonderful review of A Complete Unknown by James Cullingham earlier this week. So a lot out there on the website for you to check out. Of course, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldestnews@gmail.com. So with that, I will say thanks so much for listening, everybody. Happy 2025. Hope you're doing well. Had a great holiday season. We're back at it, back in the swing of things with weekly episodes. So please do join us again next Wednesday for more What's Old is News.